Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in Marion County and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA KRLS. And now with today's In-Depth, here is Dr. Bob Leonard.
Iowans were among the dominant forces in the race car world immediately after World War II, and the author of a new book about them is coming to Knoxville on Friday. Let's go in depth with John Havoc, author of The Ghosts of NASCAR, The Harlan Boys, and the First Daytona 500. So, John, what brings you to Knoxville?
Well, I've written this book about Johnny Bukamp, Dale Swanson, and Tiny Lund, and they were stock car racers that started after the Second World War, and the book is just being published by the University of Iowa Press, October 2013.
And what's the title?
The Ghosts of NASCAR, and then a subtitle, The Harlan Boys and the First Daytona 500.
First, a couple of things. You've really intrigued me with the ghosts part of it. And then the other thing is that the University of Iowa is a very fine press. It must be a pretty good piece of work. And I don't see a lot of NASCAR titles out of the University of Iowa. So you must have put together something really special.
I worked hard on the book. And I'm surprised no one else has ever thought to write the story of these three people up. And no one else ever thought to investigate further what happened in that first Daytona 500. So, indeed, I must have put the book through 10 revisions. At least I interviewed several hundred people, scoured libraries, microfilm rooms, just did everything I could do to gather information. And then once Iowa had the book, we put it through what I seemed like about three more revisions after that, the last time they sent it off to a New York freelance writer to kind of work through any other little details and errors I might have. So I would say that everyone tried as hard as they could.
Well, can you give us a little basic outline of the story? What makes these guys special?
One thing is it's an interesting tale when people begin with almost nothing, you know, whether it's the Beatles or a politician or anyone, and they can just come from just this little cornfield and the cornfields in southwest Iowa and get clear up to basically the pinnacle of racing. And it happened to these three people, just racing around on fair tracks at the beginning and just little farm tracks. They got clear to the top, and I think that's one thing that makes it quite interesting. And they had some very exciting times along the way, getting from virtually nothing to the top. And in the case of Johnny Bukamp, people pronounce his name all kinds of ways, I might add. The family pronounced it Bukamp, and my grandparents lived in Harlan, Iowa. I grew up in Omaha, but I always heard the name pronounced Bukamp, and Bukamp himself, Johnny Bukamp, never minded how the name was pronounced, so it doesn't matter to me or him at this point.
Well, and what time period are we talking about?
They started after the Second World War, and they started with, Tiny Lund, the third person group, race motorcycles and anything he could find with a motor, he'd race it. But Bukamp started with old jalopies and hot rods, and they raced hot rods in 1949. And his mechanic Dale Swanson, without a successful mechanic or driver, is not going to be very successful either. And it just was blind fortune and luck that in this town of Harlan, Iowa, you had several of the very best drivers, which turned out to be the best drivers in the nation, and one of the best mechanics probably in the nation as well. And so they just cleaned up in the hot rod era in 1949, but people were getting killed all over. There were two deaths in Council Bluffs at hot rod races. There was other deaths near Des Moines, Iowa, actually, in hot rods. And so it just wasn't the kind of thing. I believe it was Des Moines, Iowa. I might have to check that. But there were deaths all over with these hot rods. They were not safe racing vehicles. And so the transition quickly evolved into racing old model stock cars and then late model stock cars as well.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with John Havoc, author of The Ghosts of NASCAR, The Harlan Boys, and the First Daytona 500.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story of what happened at Daytona?
Yeah. Along the way, you know, just to kind of build it in, Johnny Bukamp and Dale Swanson, they were driving Chevrolets at the time. They transitioned in 1955 to late models, and in 1956, Bukamp won, by my count, 38 feature races in his Chevrolet with Swanson as the mechanic. And it was just an unprecedented number of wins. I mean, Chevrolet won about five races in NASCAR, and Swanson and Bukamp won 38 in the Midwest, from Shreveport all the way up to Canada, just straight through the whole Midwest. And then Swanson was taken as a Chevrolet racing, the national Chevrolet operation, actually hired Swanson to come south to Atlanta and build race cars for the 57 Beach Race. So there was a big build-up coming into the 59 Daytona 500. The Daytona, the beach was getting built up with condos. It was a dangerous thing. They were dependent on the tide to keep the course safe and smooth. And that's where the races were. It was a great race to be out there on the beach racing up and down and around. They went north on the beach and down on the highway, but it made an oval. But the thing was about it, it just wasn't suitable in the long run for racing. And they'd moved off in 1959. NASCAR moved their big race, built this 2.5-mile track. Well, as it turned out, Swanson didn't have a car for it. And the arch rival of Bukamp and Swanson for almost a decade were the Burdicks from Omaha. Roy Burdick was the mechanic. Bud Burdick was the brother of Roy. And then Bob Burdick drove late models. He was the son of Roy. Well, Roy Burdick, the mechanic, had a chance to enter a T-Bird in the 1959 Daytona. He paid $5,500 for it, but he didn't have a driver. His son was in the military. Bud was working every day, and he asked Bukamp to drive the car. So they went down, Johnny Bukamp and Roy Burdick, and entered this T-Bird in the first Daytona 500. Bukamp won the race. He was near the front for almost the entire race. There was no doubt that he was up near the front. Suddenly, on about lap 150 of the 200-lap race, it was 2.5 miles around the track, suddenly on lap 150 or 149, Petty shows up right with the leaders. And Petty claims that he won after the race and everything. And 3 days later, NASCAR says Petty won. And it was quite an interesting turnaround. Now, I have 6 chapters laying out the evidence about what it looked like and why Lee Petty, Richard's father, why Lee Petty probably didn't win.
What did he do, cut across the dunes or something?
Well, of course, they were on the big 2.5-mile track, but which was just built. But what happened, I started looking at it. It just kept getting a little more complicated and a little less likely that Lee Petty won. There's no definitive thing that can be said that who won it, almost, it seems to me. But back in the old days, in the 50s and even the 40s, these racing associations were just operating on a shoestring. There was no money. Bill France, the guy who ran NASCAR, there was no money around really to do much of anything. And so they allowed wives and friends and strangers even to come in and count the laps. And so this was the first flaw, an administrative flaw in the system, was taking volunteers to count the laps. And, of course, it would have been expensive to pay people to count laps. They used volunteers. But so Lee Petty's wife counted the laps for his car. Well, if somebody goes back and looks closely like I did, and the other thing back then, what they did was the race drivers just forgot the last race and just went on to the next race. They didn't really have a lot of time or interest in history of this. So from one race to the next, it was just all time one again. They just began. Well, if you look at it, in 1958, there was just a race where almost the same thing happened that happened at the Daytona 500 in 59. The entire race was led by Curtis Turner, except for the last lap. And suddenly, Lee Petty comes kind of out of nowhere, goes around Turner the last lap, and claims that he was the winner. And the 12,000 fans and the officials and everyone else thought that Turner was at least a one lap ahead of Lee Petty. They count the laps, and it's all in the written down. And Curtis Turner actually just verbally accuses Elizabeth Petty of adding laps. Speedy Thompson was second before all this, and he threatened to quit racing. And he made some very perceptive statements about what it could do to racing if you could unravel a race by just lap counting problems. Well, so, and then that wasn't the end of it, you know. Then there were other instances of the very same thing happening in other races, and so it just started looking like a pattern. If it had just been the Daytona 500, it would be very hard to believe that something like that might have happened. But there was a pattern. There really was. There was a pattern, and it was Lee Petty demanding a lap count and then ending up with one more lap. And so that's the first thing. Then you have Bill France in about 1965 writing a book with a co-author about all his racetracks and races, and they describe some of the races. And Bill France, basically, the race he describes at the first Daytona 500 is not the race that happened. He basically says that Lee Petty was leading Buchamp for most of the race. And in fact, Lee Petty was behind Buchamp for most of the race. And in fact, Lee Petty was so far behind, no one really paid much attention to him. And, you know, back then you could spread those cars way out on the track. People didn't really know where anybody was hardly in that first year on that race. They weren't prepared for it. So there were these things going on. And there was this rumor that was going around that people told me about, that there was a rumor that this was happening, that there were problems with the lap counting. And so these things were all in the mix back at the time. And people believed, some people believed that it was happening. They'd seen it happen in a few cases, or they thought they had. And so after that race, there was a big argument around in the pits, and certainly Buchamp's pits was just within a few stalls of Lee Petty's, and they believed, the Buchamp pits believed that Lee Petty had probably made two extra pit stops beyond what Buchamp made. Some of the cars had tire trouble and other things, and Buchamp didn't. He just made the normal pit stops and changed one tire, I believe they changed one tire. The Buchamp pits thought Petty was well lapped. You know, they always believed they had won the race. Not only Johnny Buchamp thought so, but Roy Burdick, the owner of the car, and the Buchamp pits. There's people out there now who are still upset about it. You know, they don't really want to talk too much about it, but they admit that it probably happened.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with John Havoc, author of The Ghosts of NASCAR, The Harlan Boys, and The First Daytona 500.
Wow, so a fascinating book that people that are fans of Iowa history and fans of racing would be interested in then, it sounds like.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a little more there than there's the coming from nothing all the way up. There's a few very exciting races and just things that happened. Well, I won a race in 1952, and it happened almost something similar in NASCAR in 2013, you know, and it's kind of interesting how the ethics of racing is there's things out there that, that they try to do to win, and some of them are probably considered fair to do and take that kind of risk or do that kind of thing. Others are maybe questionable, and some are outright, you know, violation of some rule. So this kind of comes out in the book, what kinds of things can happen in the racing. And certainly Buechamp and Swanson and Tiny Lund were very interesting characters. Buechamp was a very handsome man. He was just, he was professional before there was such a thing, or possibly before there was too much of such a thing. He was not employable very much. He basically raced. And the same thing went for Tiny Lund. Those guys just were racing all the time, and Lund was like a kid his whole life, out of control and kind of doing whatever he wanted. Buechamp, pretty conventional, he was very handsome. He chased women, and he basically had quite a life there for himself in some respects. And then there was Swanson, the mechanic, for much of – Buechamp won 5 season championships in the Midwest. He was a 2-time champion in Council Bluffs. He was 2-time IMCA champion, which was, you know, all through the late model. And then he was a champion in Peoria, Illinois in 1966. And so Buechamp was a very formidable driver. And the fact that he'd come down to Daytona, play second on the beach race in 57, and then win the 59 race, it was certainly within the realm of possibility. And the newspapers characterized him as a car salesman, which was he did sometimes, but it was nothing that he was vastly more than that. And of course, Tiny Lund won the Daytona 500 as well. But Swanson, he was the kind of the businessman of the group, and he's well known. It's kind of almost idiosyncratic. He fussed and worried over his engines and cars, and he'd sit there. He'd be standing there with his cigarette ash just building. He'd never take the cigarette out. Everyone I talked to about him, oh, Swanson, the cigarette. It was always the ash. He'd let it grow out as long as the cigarette. People couldn't believe the ash wouldn't fall off the cigarette, but it never seemed to do that. And you know, he was the Boy Scout leader there, and kept everything going. And his cars were very fast. People were coming from states away to buy engines from him. It wasn't just Southwest Iowa. He was like an arms supplier, supplying cars for all these guys at different tracks and things. So these guys were very interesting people.
And so people can come and meet you and buy copies of the book and talk to you more about this at the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame and Museum at 2:00 on Friday afternoon. Is that right?
I'm intending to do a little talk and be there, and there should be books there some way or other, and I'll be glad to sign them and what have you. So anyone who wants to visit, that'd be great.
Thanks to John Havoc for contributing to the program. For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
In Depth is available for podcast in the radio audio media player on KNIAKRLS.com. You'll find additional information, pictures, and more, or subscribe to the In Depth podcast and never miss an episode. If you have local topics you'd like to hear on In Depth, send an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's news and local information is KNIAKRLS and KNIAKRLS.com.